Hello and welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of MTG Potpourri. Joining me live in audio and visual splendor is Adam Saborsky.
Hi, everybody.
Jazz Hands. And Conley, who's picking his nose.
What? What? Oh.
Oh.
He's like,
no, that was real. I went real Tom. I'm a method actor.
What a homeless
that's,
man.
That's some Heath Ledger level stuff there, yeah. Man.
Guys, we are a Magic podcast, so should we really throw a curveball to all of our listeners and viewers by actually talking about Magic first thing out of the gate?
Yes.
How many bunnies
can you actually But Adam, this is not a freebie. This is we're bartering, if you will. If we get to start on Magic first, I get to tell my snake story. At Fine. Some point in the podcast.
You know what? We put it off before. We teased it at the end. Let's have a solid Magic cast. Let's hit our topics. Let's move through them briskly. Let's have some agreeable and also contentious discussion. And then we'll unleash the snake story. So, if you hate Magic and you want the snake story, just skip ahead to where, like, Conley and I are, like, pulling out the barf bags.
Skip
like,
the so. Foreplay. Skip all the fun. Go straight to the snake story.
Yeah, we'll let you know. I'll make a very distinctive snake-like motion when you know it's time.
So you
can just scrub right along the bottom, right? But before that, let's actually talk Magic.
Do it.
But before that, we're going to talk about duck penises. Just kidding.
But more importantly, we have Conley back. That's what's important.
Oh yeah, I did miss an episode. I forgot.
You did, but your internet now works.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, running that, you know, that Tor client just for, you know, 68-year-old women porn.
First of all, we said when we screen shared that we wouldn't tell anybody else, and you just broke that promise.
Yeah. Where's the piece of paper that I signed? There's not one.
You're just a bad friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know what, Tom? There was no piece of paper, but you broke something more important, and that's Conley's heart.
Yeah, but I will comb his hair with this very pink safety first child hairbrush that I have next to my computer.
Well, that was just some good Magic talk, guys. Let's get to the snake story.
Whatever.
In the world's slowest... Oh! This is on the podcast, but I want to get your guys' opinion. Do we even... It's about a week after it all happened. Do we even talk about the whole Patrick Chapin meltdown thing?
It's not a meltdown. It's we can definitely talk about that, sure. Briefly.
It was interesting that somebody who was not actively watching the Pro Tour and just randomly getting bits through Twitter also and like...
Sure, we'll discuss that later, but let's not start off on that, because that is not super Magic-related, but Magic-related.
Yeah, it's more... It's covered... Like, how do you
why
do
don't
cover
use that as our snake story transition?
Yeah, snake story transition.
Yeah, okay. We've all brought a topic to kind of cover this week, and then we'll do that one kind of quasi-Magic discussion topic story, and then snakes.
When do I get... I do have Smush in here today. His eye's looking a lot better. Do you want to see Smush now?
No, we're going to leave.
Yeah, let's get Smush at the end.
He's napping right now. You don't want to disturb him.
Yeah.
He's licking his butt.
It's napping. It's
which is tough. When you're a Persian and the face is flat, it basically means your entire face is in your butt.
Hey, let's not get into race relations, Tom. Come on.
No, his face is deformed. That's just the basic. It's called mid-face apoplasia. Basically, you just removed my nose. That's Smush. I had to take him to a cat ophthalmologist last week. I actually went to a cat ophthalmologist last week for this cat. Well, we didn't share about this, that we found out why his eye was so messed up. He has herpes in his eye. Cat herpes.
Well, good job, Tom. Smush is getting more than ever before.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you could tell the vet ophthalmologist is like, do I tell him how? He's like, no, they get it when they're a kitten. So I'm just like, I really don't know how else he would get it, because he doesn't get to leave, ever. I'm pretty sure if he went outside, he'd immediately be swooped on by an eagle and disappear forever.
I really have nothing to contribute to this conversation.
You know, we tried. Everyone listening, we tried to start on Magic, and Tom refused.
Shut up. I didn't say anything.
Bring it back, Adam. Cat eye herpes, how do you segue to Magic from that one?
You don't. Throwing. You just jump. So, Magic. So let's segue from cat eye herpes to Target. Closed down in Canada, so yay if you had anything good to buy on their closing clearance up there. It's a shame for everybody that was working.
Target's gone from Canada?
Yeah, they closed all their stores. That's a thing that's been happening. But, more importantly, last weekend, Target released one of their most anticipated lines of products in-store ever. I was not familiar with this designer, but apparently I also didn't go to like college in the last year in the South anywhere in the United States, so I wouldn't have a reason to. But Lilly Pulitzer partnered with Target for basically like an affordable line of clothes and accessories and products designed by her in her distinctive style and kind of look. If you're familiar with Vera Bradley, it's kind of a similar look to that. Very bright colors, big patterns.
Are you describing muumuus or what?
Yeah, okay. The pattern of the fabric that's commonly used. It's just a very big, bright pattern.
There's a bunch of different kinds of clothes. It's not just one thing, Tom. It's like a whole line of clothes.
These are all the world's ugliest clothes. Lots of zigzags and polka dots.
Tom, some of our viewers might be wearing those clothes right now.
If you're wearing
I'm judging them right now. Not even silently like most Minnesotans do. Out loud.
So basically, what is typically Lilly Pulitzer's designs are hundreds of dollars for dresses, just very, very upscale designer type clothes. Just that's the expectation, you know, limited runs, difficult to find, considered a premium product, very desirable, very stylish, simple, basic fashion happening here. So they released these accessible products in Target, also available in limited amounts online. So basically it's a premium product that is in high demand, considered, considered excellent. A lot of people want this, and basically released at MSRP. So Magic players at home, let's play a quiz. What do you think happened? A, everybody got to buy what they wanted, and there's plenty of additional clothes available in Target. Or B...
It's all Jordache, though, now, yeah.
Yeah, or B, a bunch of people queued up, the first ones through basically rushed, bought as much as they possibly could all at once, basically clearing out the line in minutes, then immediately flipped and listed it all on eBay.
That's capitalism.
I'm going to go with C... Everyone politely sat in a circle and played Duck, Duck, Goose.
Conley?
Duck, Duck, Grey Duck. You got it wrong. Sorry.
Oh. Whether it's Duck, Duck, Goose or Duck, Duck, Grey Duck, you're wrong, Conley. Tom, what do you think?
There's a bunch of old ladies in very bright colored patterns just beating the shit out of each other. I'm pretty sure no Target. So would you hit the sports sections first to get like a baseball bat on your way to the Lilliputian collection? I can't remember what you called it, but...
The problem with that plan is you would not have had enough time, Tom. By the time you got to sports, found an appreciably structured baseball bat, because you probably want an aluminum one so you can miss the rack and have the bat continue to function. And by the time you would have gotten over there, you would have found empty racks.
Yeah, but I just go club the people in line. I still win.
Until you're arrested. So basically, what every Magic player already knows about, all the things that you see when people talk about, like, oh, I couldn't get a hold of this from the vaults thing, or, oh, why is this only available at this convention, that this limited availability sold at MSRP type deal, it was just an absolute train wreck. Exactly what happens anytime there is high demand for a premium product sold at MSRP, and I just found it incredibly amusing that instead of angry Magic players, it was, you know, angry Southern Belles mouthing off to each other and just doing the exact same thing that that anybody else in a position to buy something cheap and resell it for much more would do.
I guess at least I would get a chance, though. Again, if I was willing enough to hurt other human beings, I could have gotten some of these clothes.
I really don't understand why you even need, like, I don't get the idea of this limited edition clothing line sold in a massive retail store. Like, I understand, like, limited Vera Wang wedding dress made in France and shipped over in a carton of gold. But, like, if you're selling something in Target, why the hell are you making it a limited edition? You're selling it in one of the biggest retailers in the world. Like, that's the dumbest thing ever. Like, your limited edition is 10 million units. Like, what the hell is that? Come on.
Well, I mean, it's exactly for the same reason that Wizards has limited release products. I mean, not exactly the same reason, right? So let's talk about that a little bit. Like From the Vault. What does it really do? So From the Vault does a bunch of things. It provides an avenue to reprint cards independent of any constructed, any limited or constructed environment, right? You don't have to find room for them in Modern Masters 2 in the draft environment there, or add a card to Modern. You don't have to put it in a Commander deck and have some pre-constructed card that has a $50 reprint inside of it. You don't have to put it in Standard, you know, because then you end up with things like Thoughtseize that people complain about, and or it's a card that's overpowered and kind of skews the format, or could skew the format and makes it weird. You can just dump it in and reprint it, and it's great, and it's just accessible. People know what they're getting, so it's unlike almost any other product Wizards puts out. You know, it's pre-constructed. You know exactly what you're getting, and everybody gets that when they buy it. And it provides a way for brick and mortar stores to effectively have an exclusive product to generate awareness and traffic to those local stores. Right? The business model seems to be based on let's grow organized pay, let's grow in-store purchases and traffic, and having a limited product that's desirable and premium of cards that you don't get to find anywhere else in Magic anymore seems like a pretty good way to push those people to the stores. So that's the final thing that it allows is it allows the brand to prevent dilution. Right? So, like, that's what Modern Masters and Modern Masters 2 does. Like, Tarmogoyf is a mythic rare. They reprinted it, and everybody said, oh, they're reprinting it. Therefore, the value of that card must go down, and the opposite happens. And I strongly suspect kind of a very similar track will happen with Modern Masters 2, that as more people find it slightly easier to get into Modern, the demand goes up, and therefore price reacts accordingly. So if you're a fashion designer, right, and you want to go to mass market and have a wider availability of your product while maintaining its desirability. That is, just not everybody can necessarily have it. That's where you have a limited release. You know, it's still a premium product. It's still desirable, but you don't have just an unlimited number popping out in, clothing booster packs. I don't think they sell clothing in booster packs, at least not.
That would be kind of cool, where you put it was like a random collection of clothes in a box.
Sounds like the most terrible thing. Like that's actually a great analog for buying booster packs to find a Magic card that you need. Like, I need a black shirt. Let me buy a couple boosters of shirts and see if I can find a good black one.
I used to buy a regular T-shirts in bags when I was in college, because they were like 50 cents a piece.
Yeah, you get like three or four of them, you're good to go.
Yeah, and hopefully two or three of them would fit on a human body, which is usually was the end. There was like one would just be like kind of like one would be like this. You'd just be like, I guess it still covers my nipples and my shirt.
The other side to make a match.
So,
yeah. How did we talk this much about Lily Pulitzer? What were we talking this in relation to?
Yes, this was just all about. We were just making Adam was making a comparison between this and the Magic Online collector sets. That's all he's done.
Well, I was going to talk about the collector's edition. I mean, is there like a new From the Vault or something coming out soon? That
I mean, later this year, there's another one.
They release a From the Vault every year, and they release like some special set. Like Modern Masters 2 is a collector set, effectively. A little different.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, Modern Masters 2 stores have just started to take pre-orders, more or less. At least some local stores, distributors. You know, we're close enough that distributors are starting to get confirmations on what they expect in. Therefore, they're starting to look at the allotments that stores have asked for and dividing that up. So, I'm starting to see the rumbles and discussions of, hey, my store said it's only getting half of the Modern Masters 2 it wanted. You know, and now they said that they have to have, like a priority queue to make sure like people get what they want. So pre-orders get fulfilled first. Should I pre-order? Like, it's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if there's ever a good answer for everyone for that kind of stuff, but limited products are beyond just Magic and people react just the same. So if you think Magic is unique in terms of having stupid expensive products that people complain about, whether they're sold at MSRP or five times MSRP, you're not alone.
I have a related tangent. So Modern Masters 2 Grand Prix at Las Vegas coming up quickly. It's about 6 weeks away.
There's been, 15,000 people in it, as far as I can tell?
Right now, there is the current. Currently, it's pre-registered as the largest tournament ever, Magic tournament ever. So more people are pre-registered than pre-registered for the last GP Vegas. I would expect, I would guess, about 7,000 to 8,000 at the end would be somewhere in the ballpark what I would expect. I don't think we're going to hit the 10,000 mark, but it'll still be gigantic. Just related to that, though, this week I got all my house details. I'm going to be out there with some friends for basically a week, Tuesday to Monday, in a house having fun. I'll be at the bounty events on Thursday and Friday. There's two different bounty events this time, which is basically you join a – so the whole entire Grand Prix is hosted by Channel Fireball, I should say that. And then basically the way a bounty event it works is you join up, you build a sealed deck, and there's a bunch of pros in the same bounty – in the same event as you. And if you happen to be paired against a pro and win, you win a ton of – you win a box of cards, basically. And you just walk away, like, super happy and whatever. So I'll be playing two of those events. So if you want to possibly get a chance to play me, or just – obviously you can come talk to me between rounds and stuff regardless. But that'll be happening. And then there's also a meet and greet that is happening – after on Friday after the bounty event, if you paid the I think it was like the platinum entry fee, it came with like this meet and greet thing. So maybe some of our listeners did, but I'll be there for a couple hours. There's gonna be like barbecue or something like that, and people hanging out and talking Magic. So
when I think Las Vegas, I think barbecue.
Well, I don't know what I say barbecue, but it'll be some type of food. Vegas has basically the best of every type of food there, so I don't really worry about what kind of food it is. And then, of course, the Grand Prix is on Saturday and Sunday itself. So if nothing else, if you're at the Grand Prix, say hi. Adam, are you going to be there?
I'm going to be working. It's going to be awesome.
I think I would. This is one of the few tournaments where I would probably rather want to work than play, because playing in this, these are exhausting. I know working is too, obviously, but at least you have a station you can go back to. When you're playing, you're like every round you have to find a new table that's like your zone because some other table got taken over by 13 groups of people. It's absurd.
I don't think we're going to change anybody's plans from here, but I really believe if this is like one of your first Grand Prix, or you know, you're X and two early in day two, don't be afraid to pull the trigger and just drop.
Oh, God, you're telling people to kill themselves.
So much more fun doing things that are not trying to fight your way through a crowd of 4,000 people times two over and over and over, beating your head against the wall, trying to stay alive till the end of the day. Like, take care of yourself first.
It's exhausting.
You will have so much more fun finding things that make you entertaining, sticking with a friend, following, you know, having people that you know to talk to and hang out with, then you will grinding this event. It's definitely very different from other Grand Prix. Everybody that I talked to that was in the main event last time was just, you know, it was just a leap beyond what any Grand Prix should feel like. And after seeing how people really didn't take care of themselves and really some of them got themselves in some pretty serious trouble, just making some really bad plays, you know, getting game losses, just, you know, it's much more challenging. Seeing them at a Grand Prix New Jersey was extremely large. It was, I think 3,000 some people, trying to remember 3,800. And it was just a very poor experience for some people that just refused to say, you know what, I need to step aside at this point. So that would be my recommendation. I don't know if you can add to that, Conley. You were actually in the last one, right?
Yeah, I actually 0-2 dropped the last one. I opened a pretty mediocre pool with like one rare, and I was 0-2. I hadn't even come close to winning a game yet. And I had everyone I was playing had these insane cards, of course, because basically when you're in a field that large, there are so many sealed pools open that very quickly the best of them rise to the top. So once you've gotten a few rounds in, if you're doing well, you are playing against a good sealed deck. It's not like just necessarily you. I mean, maybe you're playing against a pro, but the number of pros percentage-wise is much smaller. So generally, when you're 7-0, let's say, in a Grand Prix, you're either playing an extremely good player or against an extremely good deck. And when you're at a Vegas Grand Prix where the density of pros is so much smaller, you're probably playing against really good decks from, like, the 5-0 bracket onward. Like, you were just, like, bombs and crazy removal just coming at you left and right. So if you have a mediocre deck and you're like, clinging on for dear life and you need to win three rounds in a row, but you're, like, you know, maybe a little hungry and thinking about getting food or whatever, it's like you use more mental energy and physical energy for those three rounds than you would like seven rounds in normal Grand Prix, just because you don't have a comfortable space to go back to. You don't have a friend group that's like always, you know, doing the same thing. Like generally at a Grand Prix, my friends are like playing Rummy or something, and I'll just go and hang out with them between rounds, or maybe we'll go get food, or, you know, you'll text somebody and be like, hey, I'm done, where are you? And then you go find them. You just cannot do that because the room is 30 times bigger than what you're used to. There's infinite white background noise because everybody's having conversations and stuff. It's just a lot going on. And while you're actually playing the games of Magic, it's not that bad, but that's just such a small part of what a Grand Prix is. It's not just playing the games. So I 0-2 dropped, knew my pool was not going to be able to win out, or maybe it was like a, let's say, a 1% chance, but it just was not worth it to grind that long. And instead, I went, hung out at some friends, had a party house, and I had an amazing weekend, actually. It was a ton of fun. Went and did typical Vegas things, you know, eating at the buffets, going out to shows, whatever. And, you know, Vegas has so many options, and they're all really close to where the tournament is. It's not like you're, like, going very far. Not to mention public transportation is really easy to get. So, like, be sure to – you'll read this all the time in articles. They're like, when you go to a tournament, there's more than just Magic there. GP Vegas is certainly the epitome of that. Like, be sure to enjoy yourself and enjoy your time there. Come away with some stories. It doesn't have to be all about the Magic. If you're 9-0 day one, great. Enjoy it. Run with it. But there are very few people that are going to be in that position. So if you're not in that position, just enjoy yourself and come away with a good time.
So for us that maybe aren't too familiar with the GP in Vegas, where is it being located? And, like, where is that in relation to, say, like, the Strip?
I don't know the name. I'll have to look it up.
It's at the Las Vegas Convention Center, I believe it's just a few blocks off the Strip.
Okay, so it's pretty close. I mean, so you can easily go do fun stuff even. Okay.
Yeah, it was like cool. Our house was like 5 minutes from the Strip and like 3 minutes from location, so I assume the Strip and location are close.
Okay. I've been to Vegas for, I think, half a day, so my Vegas knowledge is very, very little.
All right, what are we talking about next?
So we got Grand Prix Vegas out of the way. So it sounds like everybody's pretty excited.
I added that on to the end of Adam's thing. So it just happened to be a 10-minute thing.
Well, I wanted to delve into a little bit of Magic history. So we're talking about a Magic history lesson. Because every once in a while, if you decide to have an argument on Twitter, you find out you're wrong. So I had to be aware that I was corrected. Is Adam and Conley, I believe we already talked about, but you are both familiar with what the Collector's Edition is.
Yes, just to quickly break it down for everybody. Collector's Edition, I guess I don't know exactly why they were printed. I assume just to make money for WotC. I don't think they had a specific purpose. But they were effectively the equivalent of those tournament decks, the pro player tournament decks, where you get cards, they have the real art of the cards, but they're not tournament legal, and there's a reason why. Those pro player decks had gold borders, so they were like very obvious that you couldn't play with them, and they came with blank cards and stuff. Collector's editions on the front looked like a normal Magic card, and they were all alpha and beta cards. They looked like a normal Magic card. On the back is where they had those gold border, or I guess was the entire back gold, or I think it was just
gold. Exactly like those the Pro Tour decks, where the back, instead of just being the black strip around the back, that was gold.
Yeah, it was the gold border. And the other difference is that they were not made to be necessarily played with, I don't think, but they were card size, but they were made exactly right angled cornered. So they all have like basically pieces of paper. Whereas if you look at a Magic card, you might think that it's like that, but it actually has a curved beveled corner on it that makes it to where you don't get paper cuts and they just slide into each other easier, et cetera.
Yeah, so I pulled up a little bit of information about this because I had...
They're old. This was like a 16-year-old product.
Yeah, exactly. So basically Beta came out. Beta was released, so this is the actual Beta edition for Magic. Came out October 4th, 1993. And then the Collector's Edition, which is listed as being a special commemorative edition of Beta, came out December 10th of 1993.
Oh, it was the same year.
So it makes it even weirder to me at this point. And according to this very old sort of Magic history book, is that they listed that there was 13,500 copies of this set made.
And keep in mind, it's not like Beta was much different than that.
Yeah, no, so according to another source I could find, so I was curious what the print run was for Beta, is apparently Wizards announced way back when that they had made 7.3 million beta cards.
Beta, yes. And then alpha was like something ridiculously low, right?
Yeah.
Like 20,000 or something?
I could try to pull up from the kind of the
similar source. Quarter of a million. It was like 250,000.
I knew it was in the thousands compared to millions. It was like completely different. That's why like it really surprises me that alpha cards are not worth so much more than beta cards. And it's mostly for aesthetic reasons, but it's considering how much less of them there were, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and also doing the same research, I read some of the reasons why they changed the corner shape going from alpha to beta. Do you guys, have you ever read into this, why they changed the corner shape?
I assume it's for the same reason that playing cards are like they are, and that's just that you can shuffle them easier, they don't stick when you're...
But why did they go from like kind of the fatter round corner of alpha to kind of the tighter round corner of beta, and now for the rest of Magic?
I don't know. Do you have an answer?
Yeah, apparently Cardamundi, they're the ones that printed Magic cards up until actually not too long ago. Maybe like, 5-6 years, I think, they were the printers of Magic cards. They basically had to, since the Magic cards were so popular, I mean, they printed 7.3 million versions of beta, that basically the shape of alpha is basically the exact same as like a playing card. Like if you get like a bicycle card, it's basically the exact same shape. But really that stamp or cutter... it was not designed to pump out 7.3 million cards, so they got a new die that was this shape that apparently was just faster for them to push out. It also allowed for more, it allowed for a bigger card frame and bigger art, because the corners were, I guess there's less corner if you want to think of it that way.
You go closer to the end. And then they just, since then, they just copied that design, basically?
Exactly. So they just, and eventually by the time Cardamundi wasn't printing anymore, that was the official standard for Magic. They're not going to change it again at this point. So yeah, I just thought it was interesting that this collector's edition came out so soon after beta came out. It was a very limited print run. As you mentioned, you know, square, gold back. Did you guys realize that there was a second version of collector's edition called international edition? I had never heard of this before I started doing this research.
Are they foreign cards? Or what are they?
Yeah. Yes and no. It also came out in 93. This was basically the international version of collector's edition. It says there's only 3,500 copies of the set made. And the only difference between the international and domestic version is the international edition on the back of the card, there's actually some text that says international edition. I was just like, I never actually have seen any of those ever.
Yeah, I owned a collector's edition set back in the day. I can't remember what I sold it for. It was a couple thousand, I want to say, maybe a little bit less. It was, but they, as we talked about before the show, they hit popularity for a while because people were turning collector's edition cards into pieces of power and dual lands and whatnot by removing the back of the card because the back had the gold border and then the front looked mostly like a card. So they would remove the back. They would basically glue a different Magic back on, like from a basic land or whatever. They would usually try to find an older one so it wasn't obvious. And then you would cut the corners to make them match the cards because they were square as opposed to round. And then once you did that, if you did it well enough, you could basically pass it off as a piece of power. And the only way to really detect that it wasn't that, if you couldn't tell by handling it, was a bend test and convincing people to bend their Mox Sapphires in half is just like something that even if you're sure, like, first of all, the bend test has plenty of risk to it. People will say you're safe, but that's not true for alpha and beta cards. Like, there's a very good chance you ruined your card forever. So yeah, people got away with it for a while, but then, of course, over time, knowledge and education help to tell people what to look for. And, you know, you can, like, kind of move your fingers across the card and slowly, if it's glued on, you'll start to see like a little air bubble appear and whatnot. So there was a couple different tests for it, but yeah, they kind of spiked for it. I don't actually know what they're worth now, but probably eBay. Just check.
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure. From your side, does like Cool Stuff Inc. do they carry like that kind of, do they sell like any sort of Magic cards, or is it only stuff that's like tournament playable?
You know, I'm not a buyer and I don't work on that team, so I'm not as familiar. I believe, I believe any store will sell like a sealed collector's edition. I mean, it's like buying like an old sealed box of booster packs, right? Like that's just a thing that's easy to resell and typically appreciates over time.
I just pulled up Cool Stuff Inc. They have one in stock. $1,800.
Yeah, I was gonna say the one I found on eBay is $800, but it's missing five cards, which means it's both open and missing cards, so it's not gonna be worth that much. But yeah, I was gonna say probably 15 to 2,000. So Cool Stuff selling for $1,800, it makes sense.
Huh. That's I guess yeah. I wouldn't spend much money, but that still is kind of, I guess, less than I would have thought in my mind.
Well, yeah. they're not functional cards. You can only use them in like unsanctioned formats and whatnot. So, I mean, it makes some amount of sense. Like, people play with them in Cube, like Adam mentioned, and they use them as high advanced proxies. You can't really do too much with them. You could look at them, I guess.
I was just trying to see what the prices are for International Edition, if there's like even much out there. Oh, apparently there's some. I can get an International Edition Ancestral Recall for $100. That's way less than I would have thought.
That's way less than any other Ancestral Recall.
Exactly. But again, there's only 3,500 of those out there.
Yeah, but if it's there's only one of my toilet seats out there, and it doesn't mean it's worth money. Like, people need to want the thing.
Depends on what somebody will pay for it, Conley, and there's a lot of people out there.
My toilet seat out there, but I'm not selling.
That surprised me.
So. For $20, I'll stop.
So another thing that came upon, this has nothing to do with the Collectors and International Edition, is they mentioned, I could not find a site or source for this, so this could be complete bunk on a wiki page, is they mentioned that top-down cycle that was an alpha and beta. It said that there was a set of 5 rare cards that were designed. It says each of these rare cards was designed at the last minute before the release of alpha. They were never play-tested and were designed to fit pieces of unused artwork. I don't know if you'd ever heard of this. It's Island Sanctuary, Stasis, Word of Command, Sedstrol, and Birds of Paradise.
Sedstrol, I highly doubt is true because we've been told many times. Well, I guess basically the story out there is that Garfield wanted to showcase what Strictly Better was within. Like, he wanted that thing of like, look at the common
like Grey Ogre versus a Sedstrol, yeah, sort of thing.
Sedstrol, like you can get Strictly Better in the same thing if you move up rarities and whatnot. We've been told that was like a feature of Alpha, like it was very much intended. So okay. I highly doubt that was a last minute card. Although,
well, I mean, they just said they never play tested, so theoretically he could have added a sort of a late example of, you know,
The idea of filling art pieces last minute is certainly one that I'm familiar with working in the design industry. And it happened way more back then because they could not commission new art. Like, they just had to work with what they have. So I'm sure that some number of cards did that over time. I don't know if it happened for Alpha or Beta because, like, Alpha was, you know, first set. Like, he had technically infinite amount of time. There was no release schedule or anything. Like, so I don't know if that necessarily is true, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's not.
Yeah, so this is stuff I was interesting. Where read this, like 1993, that is so incredibly old and long ago. It just tells you how crazy old Magic is at this point.
You're 29 then, right, Tom?
What's that? Me? Yes. So yes, do the math, and then do the math of like he has a 1 year old. Creepy. Okay, yeah, Hugh Hefner podcasting over here.
Hey, whatever.
But I kind of wanted to. I think this would be something since I'm not. Obviously, I'm a very casual player, so I'm not going to be giving you, you know, dropping the 411 on standard, whatever's going on. That I might start delving into these just little oddities of old Magic history. So for next episode, I want to talk about Summer Magic.
Ooh, Summer Magic's a good one to talk about.
Yeah, just it's again because I mean, look, if we're talking about Beta, came out in 93. Think of what percentage of Magic players probably were not even born yet, like when these products were available in stores. A significant percent. And that's, to me, that's just a very interesting for when you start having a game that's going on for, it's going to be here for 30, 40 more years. That's craziness. We're getting to the point of like basketball where like, hey, I remember playing when they used a peach crate and we cut out the bottom of it. And now you got LeBron James, you know, who's going to have 16,000 children out there. And
you're digging it pretty quick here, Tom.
I was reading old Onion titles, and they had a great one about.
He says everything right now.
But LeBron James. Just so everyone is clear, made a non sequitur about LeBron James using the Onion as a source of information.
At least I cited it. So I said, I read this on The Onion. It's they have some amazing research. It's like, I don't know how they figure some of this stuff out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes it's more credible than
So that was my... So again, so I just want to mention about Collector's Edition. I had never even heard of International Edition. Some of the cool things about Beta. And then next podcast, we'll talk about Summer Magic. And the Blue Hurricanes. Hooah! And also, I never realized how rare, I guess, how few of those cards were made and, like, where they were actually shipped to in the real world. So if you lived in Tennessee, you were one of the lucky few.
All right. I'm stealing this back. We're talking standard. We're talking regional PTQ weekend coming up.
Do it.
For those who are qualified, this is, I believe, yeah, I'm pretty sure it is, the very first regional PTQ weekend. So you can go play in one regional PTQ somewhere. Like, for example, I'm in Colorado. We don't have one here personally. So we have to either go to Albuquerque, which is where I'll be driving to. So if you're there, say hi. Salt Lake, which is another reasonable drive. And then there might be one towards the Kansas, St. Louis area. I'm not sure. But basically, we have our choice. And you can only attend one is the big thing. I'm pretty sure there's a couple regional PTQs that won't be happening this weekend, like in special spots. But for the most part, they are happening. And then they're a little, of course, in case you don't remember, basically they're a little different where these are all people who have won PPTQs or have silver level qualifications from the Pro Tour. Those are the people who get qualified. And then you go to the PTQ. If there is less than 128 players, the top four qualify for the Pro Tour. And if there's 128 players or more, the top eight qualify for the Pro Tour. And this weekend is standard. So it should be pretty fun. I haven't been playing much Magic until recently. Just testing for this particular Pro Tour or this particular PTQ. I've been testing some rug decks I wrote about for a TCG player, some control decks using the new Sarkhan because he's basically not seeing any play right now and he's a super powerful card, so I wanted to explore him. But I think I might end up playing Esper. It's just super, like, there's quite a difference between a PTQ and a Pro Tour. Like, at a Pro Tour, I definitely like to kind of come up with a surprise factor and catch people off guard doing something that they would not expect. But at a PTQ, I don't necessarily need to leverage those skills because I have people beat in so many other areas, like just straight up skill level and whatnot. So playing something a little more consistent or with a little bit of more testing behind it is a little safer and a little more desired, especially for me who have not, since I haven't been playing a ton of Magic. So I'm thinking instead of brewing too much, I might just end up playing Esper, maybe with a few tweaks or whatnot. But the standard format actually seems kind of sweet. I like their controls back. The Dragon Lords are absurdly strong, though. That is one thing that I've quickly realized is they are basically the best thing you could be doing in this format. Regardless of which color you choose, they just all have to be insane, which is kind of cool, the fact that dragons are good. But it is a very different format than when I really last left it, which was Khans of Tarkir. Like, I didn't play much with Fae Reforged Standard. So when I left it, Khans of Tarkir was a bunch of, like, weird aggro combo decks running around, and now it's, like, the world of control all of a sudden. It's kind of cool. What are you doing, Tom?
I'm just looking at my screen.
Oh, okay.
There's, like, 6,000 windows open right now since I'm trying to record as much as humanly possible.
What standard have you been playing, Tom?
Was that?
How much standard have you been playing?
None.
Like, come on, man.
I've been playing a little bit of Modern. I'm just putting together random Modern decks, but yeah, fun Modern. So not like competitive Modern. I hadn't looked at the new Sarkhan for a while. You're right. His plus one ability is really awesome. And he can protect himself. Yeah.
The problem with him is that he requires such a specific set of mana. Like, you can't be like, you know, I can be an Esper deck, I can be a Bant deck, I could be a red white deck, and I can play Elspeth, and she's super cool. Sarkhan is, like, arguably on the same power level, but you get to play him in one place, maybe two if you're playing a five color deck. You can't really do anything else with him. And the fact that the rug colors themselves have some struggles against things like the green devotion decks and a little bit against Esper in the main deck hurts it. I like that they get things like Anger of the Gods and whatnot to deal with all the really aggressive decks right now, which makes it better against, like, mono red and stuff than Esper. But against Esper itself, I think you really rely on your sideboard, and I don't know if I'm willing to make that gamble. Like, I wrote about it in my article where you can just have, like, 10 cards in your sideboard to beat Esper, but then if Esper, you know, shows up in smaller numbers than you expected, or those people just don't win because they get pushed out by a mid-range something, like, all of a sudden you're kind of in a tough spot where you went all in on this sideboard strategy, and now you don't get to use any of those cards. And they're like very specific cards. It's like Mistcutter Hydras, more counter spells, negates, stuff like that. That, like, is not necessarily good against an Abzan aggro deck, for example.
Okay. So you mentioned, so the things you're expecting to see at the kind of the regional PTQs, you mentioned Esper.
Yeah, so I would go with starting off, you have your aggro decks. You basically have, like, a mono red deck that there's multiple ways to build it, but it's just little dudes, pump spells, burn spells is the basic premise there. You still have the heroic decks. I don't know if they're going to continue to see play or not, but they do exist, whether they're blue-white or red-white or something of those nature using heroic abilities. You also, I think, that the black decks, whether it's warriors or just mono-black aggro, I think that's a fringe archetype that people might play. Moving
on, like a tribal warrior deck?
Yeah, warriors actually have a ton of like very solid creatures, right? Like they have multiple 2/1s for one and 2/2s for one, and then they have multiple like lord effects. Like they have a 3/2 for two that gives all your guys +1/+0. Like that's a pretty solid card. So yeah, warriors is, I wouldn't call it like a tier one strategy by any means, but it's certainly a, you can show up to FNM and win a tournament
with it. Yeah, it sounds like fun though too from a playing set.
And then you have your, so there's some like weird combo decks that are kind of lingering around that they kind of have to pick their moment and go in. There's like graveyard based decks that are sort of combo-y, and then there's the Jeskai Ascension decks that are sort of combo-y. I think all those decks can be powerful and can win any given tournament, but they're a little bit of a gamble. Just because you run into somebody who's got a prepared sideboard with enough destructive revelries or graveyard hate, and all of a sudden you just can't win. It doesn't even matter what the matchup is. So it's they're less matchup reliant and more like how prepared are my opponents. And then moving up from there, you have a bunch of like aggro to mid-range decks. Abzan has basically all varieties from the 1-drop, 2-drop, 3-drop decks to like Siege Rhino is my main threat, and I play some Planeswalkers. To like, I'm playing Wrath of Gods out the wazoo and just want to kill your stuff and go really big and play Ugin. And then moving up from there, then you have like a million different control decks that everybody's trying out right now. Esper Dragons, I would say, is the number one most popular, whatnot, and uses the 2 hexproof dragons, bunch of sweepers, bunch of counter spells, bunch of removal. Basically, what you would expect an Esper deck to look like. Then there's blue black control, which is the same variety minus Ojutai, effectively. Flora suggested this. Sort of, it's like a mono blue dragons deck where it uses all of its spells are blue, but it uses all of the dragon lords, and then you use all eight. There's 8 lands right now that tap for any color mana for dragons. 1 of 4 storage lands, and then 4 of the raised dead, whatever it's called. I don't know, not spirit haven, whatever. Okay. You know, but you use all 8 of those, a bunch of blue lands, and you basically play like mono blue control with all the dragon counter spells and stuff, and then you just have like 10 dragons of all varieties at your top end that you just cast and kill
people. That also sounds really fun. I like
that. And, but there's like a lot of decks that just use these dragons in this way because they're all so powerful. They start at 5 mana, so they're not exactly fast, which is why the format's kind of slowing down. But they all just do insane things, whether it's coming to play Wrath your board, coming to play, you can't target me, I'm going to draw cards every single turn for the rest of the game. You know, just whatever they're doing something extremely strong. The format is pretty fun, I would say. There's also the mid-range go over the top decks, which are the devotion decks, basically. There's green X. There's green white, green red, etc. And that's just make infinite mana and do something degenerate with it. Those happen to be extremely weak to all the control decks, which is why they're kind of dying out. But they do beat up on all the like mid-range decks because they just go over the top like, really quickly. So it's a pretty diverse format, which is one of the reasons I'm kind of excited to start getting back into the game. With Vegas coming up and then this PTQ and stuff, I'm expecting myself. I'm getting excited about Magic again, which is a really good thing, just to be in that emotional state. Because, you know, when you do Magic as a job, it can get a little grindy from time to time, especially when you do it for so long for an extended period of time. But now I've kind of found some other things that I'm enjoying doing and dividing my time up a little bit more evenly. And Magic is one of those things where it's like I'm looking forward to, you know, those couple of hours of Magic Online when I get home, which is not something I could say for the last 6 months. So I'm pretty excited.
Any new, like, tutting or anything else that you can share?
I mean, I go out dancing. I mean, I don't particularly tut. I do. If my dancing is very much an original style that kind of blends a lot of those things I said. And it doesn't necessarily do any of those one things because I didn't like learn or get official
so
training.
Like, you're basically doing like the mid range of dance. So you kind
of No, I'm just doing a poke of dance.
Like, or is this over the top dance?
I don't know how to describe it. You would have to see me sometime.
Conley, what you just described is called flailing. You flail.
No, it's not flailing. I'm quite good. You would be surprised. I literally get crowds of like people that will just surround me and watch me dance. I don't like that. I don't like to be in like a dance circle because I don't like to make it a competition. But I'll just be dancing and they'll just like be like people. Like surround
dance off. Please God tell me there's been a dance off at some point.
There's dance offs all the time. People I don't think they're dance offs. They're basically a circle form, somebody would go do some moves and then they'll stop and then somebody else will do some moves and like they get applause and stuff, but they don't like get ratings or whatever at the end.
There's not like one of you just is declared the winner, the other one gets drug off. And
a winner, I mean, you just kind of like you do it for pride and like you know you won, or like you did something cool or whatever. Like it's not meant to be like a you got served type thing. It's
that's what I was hoping for.
Yeah,
have you seen the movie White Chicks?
Make a competition. I just like to be like they're going crazy dancing.
Adam's seen the movie White Chicks. I saw his face.
I stopped watching the movie
White Chicks. I've seen the movie at least 20 times. Own it on DVD digital.
So Conley, so it sounds like what you're saying is that we should not be looking forward to Shut Up and Dance 4 Pro Tour.
Step up to the
floor. You can make fun of me, but I am quite proud. I literally did not dance prior to about 6 months ago. It was the first time I ever danced, private or public. I just did not. I promise you. I was
champagne 20, room, normal pole, it didn't matter.
I danced for the first time, so I was just super nervous, and just it wasn't something I thought I could do. And in the last season, I have... Sorry.
I just imagine you get the nervous erection the first time you were dancing.
No, I just was like, you know, it just wasn't something I thought I would look at. Because I'm so competitive that when I do something, I really want to do it well. I don't like to, like, I don't want to do something so badly that people kind of would mock me or think I'm being whatever. And in my
head, to be a parent. There you go.
In my head, that's kind of what I thought was going to happen if I started dancing, because I was just going to be this big, goofy dude looking like an idiot dancing or whatever. And I probably was for a little while.
But I mean, you're a dad. You're just like, I don't give a shit anymore.
Yeah, but yeah, once I got it out of my head, it was just like, yeah, I really don't care what these, you know, I'm 28, I don't care what these 22-year-old kids think about me anymore, and then it's just like, start dancing, it's like, oh wait, I actually enjoy the hell out of this.
You're
like,
still young.
Well, I mean, yes, I'm still young, but I literally go out like three times a week for like 5 hours just dancing. I can't tell you, it's become like my, I wouldn't call it a passion, because it doesn't like take up the same mental space that magic or something does, where I'm like looking up things outside of the...
But you can't, because you have your own unique thing. Like,
well, I mean, I guess I don't know.
I used to like research like old like 17th century like dance. Be like, what's like a cool move I could
improve? Oh no, for like learning new. Well, first of all, I don't really have moves. I don't like. I try to. I'm a very musical person, so I try to just dance to whatever's being played musically. I don't try to like have any pre-staged anything. But to learn a new move, quote unquote, I just go out there and do stuff and. If I do something and it was like, oh, that looks like it'd be cool, then I might think about it later on and like work on it. But it's never like sit down in front of a YouTube video and watch somebody do something 100 times, because that's kind of boring.
But do you dance like in front of a mirror? Like I feel like if I was doing a move, like, I don't know how cool it looks, because I can't see me doing it.
So I mean, I've tried to dance in front of mirrors. I don't really have that type of mirror in my apartment, but I've like done it at work or whatever in like the bathroom just to try stuff. But the thing I did... I think I've done a bunch.
So you're like, dancing in the bathroom at work?
Well, yeah, of course. I dance.
Awesome.
I get on the elevator. I get so happy when nobody else is on the elevator, because I just get to dance for all the floors. It's awesome. But no, I used to what I would do is record myself. So if I would, like, when I was trying to get better with my footwork and stuff, I would just like set up my phone and record it, and then I would just dance for however long I wanted to dance, and later on I'd go back and watch it and then realize what I was messing up. So I've been doing a kind of like self improvement.
Did you ever dabble like in like DDR, like video game dance? And okay,
I mean,
love DDR.
I mean, I can't say I would hate DDR, but it just
it's not dancing, but it's fun.
I move a lot when I dance. Like I take up a lot of space and do a lot of like, I don't know, shifting of movements and dynamics and stuff. And I could just not fit on a DDR board.
I need to see videos. I don't even have a mental image of what you're doing.
I at some point somebody's going to get a video of me, and I'll be sure to send it to you, Tom.
Okay, it's just I'm not like mocking. I can't even visualize.
It is very tough to visualize. I tried to explain to my mom too, which is one of the reasons I want to get a video, just because what I do is extremely unique, but also a lot of fun. So I want to get her a video at some point. So when I do, I'll be sure to send it to you.
I would love if you sent her. She's like, oh, I dance like that, and she sent you like an old VHS tape from like the 70s of her just like doing the same thing. She's like, damn it, mom.
No. I don't know how are we talking about dancing so much? I feel like we moved off magic a long time. Adam hasn't said a word in 30 minutes. He's just been making facial expressions to disapprove of everything.
He's got great dimples, though. He's practicing his own new dimple technology there.
No, I just cannot get the Chris Farley Chippendales SNL skit out of my head right now.
I promise it is not like I promise.
Was it Swayze? Was Swayze with him on that one?
Oh yeah, this is a very good one.
Oh no, he deserves it. He's all heart. He's just the epitome of the Chippendale dancer. But no, I just want to see it because I can't comprehend it.
Everyone wants to dance with me. I'm definitely going to be hitting up some EDM clubs in Vegas. So you want to come dance with me? Do it.
Oh, no, it's BDSM. You have to have all the letters.
That's not electronic dance music.
Oh.
Also hip hop. I'll dance to hip hop, but those clubs are less fun.
Erotic disco machines.
No, just electronic dance music.
Oh, okay.
All right. We're coming up on an hour-ish of casting. It's time to begin the crescendo. This is what the entire cast has been leading up to.
Climax, some would say, yes.
The snake story.
Oh, can we do the snake story?
I think
you're gonna talk about Chapin. The whole.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
What do you want to know about this, Tom? So you basically didn't watch. So I'll give the quick 30-second rundown without getting into
too much. It's because I didn't get to experience, I guess, as it was happening. Cedric Phillips actually had a really good article sort of detailing the whole event. That's how I learned about it.
Yes.
But I was just curious to hear all the response, I guess the feedback of, it was more the coverage of this.
So, but yeah. Basically, is Patrick Chapin playing in game 3 against a person on camera. Patrick Chapin activates an Ajani. There's only one legal target. The camera is on them or whatever. This is a future match. There's only one legal thing for him to grab. He grabs it, puts it in his hand face down, puts the rest of his cards on the bottom of his deck. At this point, he basically has added a card to his hand without revealing it. So judge gets called. Judge makes a big ruling about how he's going to get a game loss, blah, 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 blah. There's a bunch of dispute over whether the camera should have been allowed to reverse this ruling, since there is video evidence that Chapin put the correct card in his hand and could not have gotten any other cards. And basically, we know that he did not cheat, even though he cheated. You know what I'm saying? He went against, he broke the rules, but he did not do it intentionally, and he did not do anything.
It wasn't malicious. It was just an accident.
Exactly. So there was a camera there. There's a lot of debate over whether or not that should be allowed. There's a ton of discussion over basically what happened is the judge call lasted 15 minutes, let's say. There was a lot of back and forth. There was a lot of, can I technically do this? Is he technically allowed to do this? And like basically, Chapin did not want to get a game loss for his first match loss of the tournament for this stupid error that he was going to win this game, blah, blah, blah. And the entire thing was on coverage. So basically, the cameras were on them the entire time. You could hear everybody talking. Meanwhile, Randy Buehler and I don't know who else was.
Marshall Sutcliffe, I think, was there.
Yeah, you're right. So they're both discussing what's going on. They're not talking about something else. They're literally discussing about this judge call. You can hear the judge call going on. And it basically came down to this thing where a lot of people felt it was unprofessional. A lot of people felt it was just in poor taste. You should have had a backup plan. You should have had some cut video to cut to. You should have been talking about something else. And basically exposing a bunch of Magic players, potentially first-time viewers and whatnot, to this big ordeal of this like rules fiasco and technicalities and whatnot was just not in good entertainment. And so there's a lot of debate over that. The call itself, really the only debate is whether or not video evidence should be able to be used as ways to overturn a call.
To like step it back, because they could, I guess, see what happened, and then they theoretically could have fixed the game state, correct?
Yeah, but based on the current rules, everything that happened legally is what should have happened. Chapin should have got a game loss. He could not get overturned. Like nothing happened that shouldn't have happened when it comes to the judge call itself. It's mostly how it was perceived, how it was shown, etc.
Well, I mean, as a pro player, people seem very offended. You mentioned the commentators during this thing, and I could pull up Sed's article about some of the things that they said, and people just livid. I read, like, I could give a shit less. I'm not sure why people are so mad.
For 2 minutes, Randy Buehler broke into a tangent about how Patrick Chapin was playing Magic during the Wild Wild West days when everybody cheated, and when a judge call happened, you had to kind of sell your position to the judge to get them to buy it, which is just not the way judge calls work these days. And Randy was kind of trying to say that Chapin was using that style, like that old school style of like influencing a judge, just like the things that he was implying that was happening would be A, illegal, and B, you're kind of throwing a player under the bus who's not really doing anything illegal, but he's just, Chapin's super flustered. Of course, he just got issued a game loss for something that was like super minor and he knows he didn't do anything actually illegal. So I can understand, Chapin being flustered there. But yeah, just the like I said, they literally were on the judge during this entire thing, and there was a lot of back and forth. Chapin was giving his position because he didn't want to get a game loss, and his opponent chimed in multiple times as well, and then the judge is chiming in, and there's an assistant judge, and there's, you know, meanwhile you just have Marshall and Randy talking about, you know, what they would do in this situation and what card should be involved. And it was just like, what? Like, we spent 20 minutes talking about this rules interaction that's just like, it's not core to Magic. It's not core to the product that we're putting out, which is the Pro Tour, and it just felt like a big derailment.
Okay, I was just kind of curious as a pro player, because I guess me from a casual player that's not super invested in, you know, like the Pro Tour, I was kind of curious what the big kerfluffle was.
Oh, I mean, I sat there and watched I went back. I didn't watch it as it happened live, but I went back and watched all the judge call happen stuff because I found it interesting as a pro player. Like, if I was in this position, what would I have done in Chapin's shoes differently? What would the judge have said to me, et cetera? Because it is a very interesting spot where it's like, I know I didn't cheat. I made a mistake. I understand that. Is there any way for me to not be punished in the ultimate way for this mistake? I think that is a reasonable thing for a person to be seeking there. So it was kind of interesting to go, if I was in his shoes, like, is there any way that I don't get screwed here? Especially given that video evidence can't be, and I don't think there is. I think once you put that card in your hand, you're just basically done for. But I did watch it with a vested interest of, like, you know, this could be me. Like, these things happen. Like, small mistakes happen. I've, on camera multiple times, have done things like put a land into play tapped when it was a Seeker on Coast, and I only had three lands in play because my Bleak Moth Nexus died the turn before, and it was supposed to come into play untapped. And a judge, this is an Pro Tour top 8, and a judge instantly corrected me, like, that land is untapped, and that I needed that land to pay for a mana leak that very turn. Like, if it had come to play tapped, I would have lost, but the judge corrected it. I mean, technically, by game rules, the land could not come to play tapped. Like, that's not a thing. You can't just put a land and play tapped. But I had still made the mistake that if a judge hadn't, like, said something, and I always think, like, if the judge didn't say something there, and I went to play my thing, and it got mana leaked, and then I went into the tank, and I'm like, oh, man, this sucks. I got my Hero Blade Hold mana leak. I'm going to lose. And I looked down at my land, and I'm like, wait, why is the Seachrome Coast tapped? Like, what would I have done? Would I try to convince the judge that it should have been on tap? I don't know. That's, like, a really tough spot to be in because you just don't think about those things. I mean, assuming you're not a cheater. I guess if you're a cheater, you probably think about those a little bit more. But those are, like, the side of Magic that you kind of – well, I mean, you have to. You have to know your ways around things a little bit more. But when you are an honest player, you don't want to think about those, like, small, hiccupy, weird corners you can back yourself into because they happen very rarely. And generally, the rules sort them out on their own. It's just like, it's straightforward. You drew an extra card on your mulligan. You have to take an extra mulligan, go down to 5 cards or whatever. Like, it's pretty simple. You don't have a lot of argument there. You screwed up by drawing 8 cards, etc.
And for your side, as being on the covered side, what was your kind of feeling about all this?
I mean, so obviously it's like, it's a little different for me. Like, because, like, I get to see, like, a lot of different sides. Like, I work very closely, particularly with judges at Grand Prix, because working on text coverage, one of the roles that I've kind of run with the past, like, year or so is I coordinate with the head judge and judge staff, make sure the feature manager is being picked, make sure deck lists are being pulled. The video team's actually just not there. You know, they've got other priorities and responsibilities they're focused on, so I'm doing a lot of kind of information flow, for lack of a better kind of term to generalize it. So I've gotten to know a lot of the judges. I've talked to a lot of them. I have a lot of respect, especially for the judges that I've seen running teams and working at the Pro Tour. They're definitely some of the best judges that I know, just period in Magic. So I can't speak for the coverage team or on behalf of Wizard or anything like that. So I'm just speaking for myself. But I, you know, when the call started, and I kind of knew exactly, like I've seen this type of situation before, like drawing an extra card at competitive REL, like it's just a game loss, like that's just what it is. And I strongly suspected, like, as the judge is making this ruling, that okay, well, clearly, like, you appeal, like there's no harm in appealing, like, you know, like any player in your shoes, like if you get a call and you're getting a game loss, like, there's no, like, judge retaliation. There's no, like, punishment for going, you know, that sounds reasonable, but I'd really like to make as sure can be, because this is a big deal for me. You know, I'm going to appeal that. You know, that's super common. So it's not like appealing to the head judge is some sort of slight or insult or anything really bad. When Ricardo came over, I know how Ricardo kind of handles calls and how he handles dealing with players, particularly players that like to express themselves and want to make their position abundantly clear and kind of not necessarily argue, but just kind of lay out the information and their perception of a situation and be like, this is what I perceive, you know, this is what I know, this is what happened, this is everything that I can think of, like, you know, I really feel like, you know, that this ruling doesn't reflect my perception of this situation, you know, and that's kind of like the main component of why appeals can happen to a head judge and why players talk to judges and provide information is if you're providing all information honestly, sometimes things do get caught on appeal or something becomes clear on a second look and those things change. So for, you know, for Chapin to do that, you know, I thought it made a lot of sense. And I know Ricardo is the type of judge that listens. He empathizes with the players. He really wants to be available and let a player work through that situation. So I knew that Ricardo wasn't going to cut Chapin off right away or at all, as it turned out to be. And Ricardo's article actually, I think, went up today on blackborder.com, and he kind of basically explained exactly what my perception was from knowing him, was that, you know, he listened. He wanted to provide the customer service, is kind of how the judges call it, of like letting the player explain themselves, letting the player talk. And there's actually kind of a secret side to that from at least my perception of it is when somebody is playing honestly, they're going to explain everything they have. They want to get it out there that this is what happened. When somebody's cheating, the more they talk, the more likely they're going to say conflicting information. So it's always in a judge's best interest to listen to a player. The longer they want to talk about a play or an issue at a table, the more likely you're going to get a better understanding of what's going on at the table. So how, you know, I think some of the conversation and kind of the color commentary, you know, around it probably could be handled better. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think it's necessarily fair to even create the implication that a player is doing something, you know, unsavory or cheating. I don't think, and I don't think that this is necessarily what Randy or Marshall were implying either. You know, I think it was more of like trying to provide context, like why would a player like Chapin argue, you know, so much? And it's, well, one, it's not arguing, and two, the context is that players discuss their positions, their rules, and it's especially true for the longer a player's been playing. They know so many different rules changes and evolutions over time. It's just natural to always explain their position and try to make sure that if you're a player, let's say you don't understand a rule correctly, right? Like, you want to make sure you explain everything you're thinking, because then that's where the judge at the very least can go, well, actually, this is the thing that you're missing. Well, that actually changed like two IPGs ago. You're just using an older rule, you know? So like, it's also a player's best interest to listen and explain why they think what they do, because the judge can also help correct that. Because if you get a game loss in one situation, you certainly want to learn what caused that and make sure you don't do that again. So it's just, you know, it's just a little bit of a weird situation. Like those situations are exceptional. And I think that's something that people haven't really pointed out, is that there are always judge calls, and there are sometimes long judge calls in almost any tournament. And that's just a law of large numbers. Like Grand Prix Vegas is going to run at what's going to feel like a snail's pace, because there's just so many people and such a high likelihood that there's going to be a bad call every single round. That's just what's going to happen. But even at the Pro Tour, there's going to be these big long calls, and it's like, for that to happen on camera and for one player to go through all of the motions and exhaust every resource they have to walk through all the information they have to verify everything that they perceive as they perceive it, that's plus, just such a rare thing to happen.
Plus, there was no other match still going on from the cut to. Like, if there had been another match still going on live, I guarantee they would have snap cut to that. But because there wasn't, they really didn't have the plan B of like, here's some video that we recorded earlier today, because this was something new to them. Like, I as much as I say it was a kind of a bad thing to watch happen, I don't necessarily blame Watsi, because this was such a rare thing, as Adam's saying, and it basically their plan A of let's cut to another match was taken away from them, so they had to go to extreme plan B, which they just didn't have ready. I think in the future, I highly doubt this will, like, I'm sure they'll have some video package, or they'll just cut to some interview that they did with somebody or whatever. Like, I can't imagine this happening again, especially after how talked about it's been. So I don't want to, like, when I say it was unprofessional, I shouldn't say that, like, it was anybody who was necessarily involved directly's fault. They were put in a very foreign situation. And while they didn't do the best thing they could have possibly done, they were at least, you know, they were attempting to put the pieces together and make it an entertaining product for the viewer. I just think that it kind of, we got to see behind the curtain a little too much, which is, it was kind of a combination of this like unfortunate event with a lack of preparedness, just hitting each other. And then we got to see it all kind of unfold. It wasn't like, you know, this happens every single pro tour and I can't believe Watsi hasn't figured it out yet. And like the Magic Online gripes, like those are legitimate gripes of like, come on guys, get this together. Whereas this is kind of like Janet Jackson's boob popped out. We can't really be too mad at NFL, you know, or at NBC for this. Like that's just a thing that happened. And now in the future, it won't happen, but you know, shaping is Janet Jackson's boob.
I was glad we got there. That's never a full podcast we get to Boobgate.
And where could you go from Janet Jackson's boob except for the snakes? Go for it.
Before the snake story, the entire time that Adam was talking about the head judge Ricardo, all I had in my mind was Ricardo Montalban dressed as Khan from Star Trek II, like trotting into the scene would be Khan in his like open shirt and
this is chair. Testaverde.
Yeah, that would be great for the viewer if Ricardo Montalban was the head judge but dressed as Khan from Star Trek II. I would call judge a lot more if I was in that tournament.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah. I think the snake story is going to be a little bit of a letdown because it's feeling like it's been brought up now for like an almost, well, we've been podcasting for over a year, so it's been a year plus.
Well, you have the option of telling a fake snake story and keeping the real one in your back pocket.
Yeah, no, let's go with the real one.
It's just aristocrats.
Or, Tom, you could next level everyone and go, you know, I don't feel like telling the snake story tonight. I think I'll hold it for another cast. Nice. And just blow everyone out that skipped to the end, and they're going to be like, what? I just skipped this whole podcast for you.
I'm not going to be a snake tease. That's just not the way that I roll here.
Yeah, you have. Once the snake's been, once you've gotten a peek of the snake, the whole snake's got to come out.
Yeah, so the snake is going to come out. It's only about a 5-minute story, so it doesn't take that long to unleash the snake.
Wait, so your snake only takes 5 minutes to be unleashed, though? That's not very. All right. Go ahead.
There's a lot of stuff to do in a day.
Start going. Unleash it.
Yeah, time me.
Put that snake in our ears.
Surprised. So this would have been roughly about my third year of medical school. So if people are not aware of medical education, your third or fourth year of medical school, you are doing what they call rotations. So instead of being in a classroom, vast majority of the time you are out like in a hospital or a clinic and you are sampling basically almost all the different types of medicine so you can hopefully pick what you want to do and also just have a breadth of knowledge. So I was on an kind of an inpatient hospital service where you are admitting people to the hospital, you get their history, figure out what to order, yada, yada, yada. This is a young man. I'm not saying it was Conley, but he was roughly Conley's age when I saw this person.
Wait, was my age now or was my age back then?
Age now. Okay. So your current age now would have been the age of this patient when we were admitting him to the hospital.
So you were younger then?
I was definitely younger, yeah. I would have been in my early 40s at that point.
Yeah.
Fairly straightforward person. Chief complaint was, I can't urinate. I can't pee. Well, I want to pee. It won't come out. It's been a few days. I'm now in a world of hurt because my bladder is about to explode. So, of course, you do a full workup exam, blah, blah, blah. You get some imaging. And what the imaging shows is that there were some radiopaque stones in the bladder. So radiopaque just means that they actually show up in x-ray. There are certain types of kidney and bladder stones. And so unless they have a radiopaque substance like calcium or something, they're not going to show up on an x-ray or a CT scan. So again, a boatload of these stones were in there. So it's like, well, that's probably the problem because you're basically you have like a bag of marbles as a bladder. So that's probably what's causing your major issue. So usually in these cases, especially when it's a younger person, you either surgically or can do a cystoscopy where you basically shove a tube over their penis and grab one of the things to see what kind of stone this is. If you know what kind of stones they're making, there are ways to hopefully prevent them from doing that in the future. So they get sent off to pathology, get it looked at, and then the next day you get back the results and you're like, oh, is this a calcium stone or blah, blah, blah? Well, no, it had bone in it. So it's like, bone? Yeah, spinal bone. Spinal column. It's like, that's not really what I expected to hear coming from the path report. So what's, you know, as the logical first step as now as being like a staff is you make the med student go ask the person why they would potentially have bones in their bladder. So shove third year medical student in there. You know, we got the results back. Do you know why there would be bones in your bladder? And it's like, you know, you're right. I forgot to mention it. But on weekends, me and my buddy, we take little baby gardener snakes and we put them up our penises because it feels good. It feels like butterflies. Alrighty. Do the snakes come back out? No, actually they don't. You've been doing this for a while? Yeah, probably 6 months to a year. It's like, okay, we've discovered the problem. These were little tiny, basically fossilized skeletons of snakes in your bladder. We removed them surgically because there's a lot of them. I'm assuming he's been back, as to him it did not apparently seem to be an abnormal behavior or something unusual. And, you know, it's like if X does Y, if, you know, I like putting these snakes in my wiener, eventually I'm going to have to get all the things taken out. That's the snake story.
I don't know why anyone would do that.
Yeah, to me, I could
just can't like maybe one, like if you did it once and you were like super drunk or something and then never did it again.
No, it's the step one that's the creepy, is like that you made this decision, I drunk or not. That
you, well, that's said, what I'm saying.
Once I have this baby gardener steak, it's still alive. It might feel good if I shoved it in.
I don't even know how you would get it like to.
Well, I think you put them in head first. So basically, I think once you get started, it's only one. I don't think snakes really crawl backwards. So there's just kind of one way to go. You feel bad for the snake. You're in a dark hole and you just crawl there and you die. That's horrible. And then you're probably up against the fossilized remains of other skeletons. Like, imagine somebody stuck you like in a fleshy orifice. You only have one way to go.
Also, how is that not the first thing you mention when you walk in? Like, I've been shoving snakes up my dick. Can you please take them out?
Yeah.
Like, he had to know that was the cause, right?
I think he had not actually made the connection. He is the world's most amazing actor.
Are you required as a person to give them like a psychiatric exam after that? Like, they have to like...
No, I mean, obviously you screen for it at that point, but no, not necessarily. There's people. There's an amazing number of people out there with what you would call fixed delusions.
Oh, well, I'm totally fine. Like if he has a weird fetish where he wants that, that's fine. But the idea, like you're saying, didn't put two and two together that this was causing his problem. Like, that to me is like mentally.
Yeah, I would guess in the problems would be sort of like lower IQ. You know,
sure, that's fair.
May not have occurred to that person. I have many more experiences like this in residency of people that would, again, from more of the mental health side where I had removed.
So once again, we've confirmed that Tom is a veterinarian.
Yeah. So yeah,
what I was about to say. If you ever needed more proof that Tom's a vet, who do the doctors call when they find skeletons in somebody's bladder?
Well, I looked through Harrison.
Must be an animal. Let's get a vet on the case.
Same thing when I removed, like, for the fourth time. Do you guys know what right stuff is? The foam, like insulation, like you can spray it into cracks and it expands.
Yeah,
I used it to seal up most of my shed. Weatherproof it.
Yeah, behind insulation, you use it a lot of places. The one place you don't use it is in your rectum. That is also the other thing that I learned in my residency. Because even though it fit in there originally, it then expands and it doesn't come out.
Somebody tried that? That would not...
I removed at least three times from the same person. So that was the world's best... The first time this happened, when I had to call poison control, you know, because I'm looking at the... We pulled up the ingredients on the webs. I'm like, could this person... Like, do we need to be treating them for, like, you know, chemical poisoning? I mean, because you can absorb a lot of stuff through your rectal tissue. So I called poison control and said, hey, I'm going to list you some ingredients. Can I absorb these through my rectal mucosa? And they're like... Are you sure this is what you're... I'm like, yes. I'm going to list you a bunch of chemicals. Tell me if I can absorb these through my anus, basically.
That's also something you have med students do for you now, though.
Yeah, I was a resident, so you still got to do that fun job.
And that, everyone, is MTG Potpourri.
There you go. This is a snake story. You got it.
And then, maybe we'll save it for the next podcast, because it's longer, but somebody did respond where we had the email about Skype, or not Skype, but Shinders, the local kind of card game store that we used to have in Minnesota that kind of suddenly disappeared and we weren't sure why. Somebody sent me an actual article from the newspaper about why this happened. And just to give you a little detail so you're excited for this podcast, the title of this official news article was Dope, Guns, and Newsprint. for why Schindler's closed down. So it's really interesting. So we'll read the whole thing next time. So I did want to say thank you to, let me pull up the email, to Toby G, who sent that in to me, just said, "Hello, fellow Minnesota Magic dork," and the link to the City Pages article.
There you go.
I thought that was pretty good. Tom,
do you have a Twitter account that people can send other newspaper articles to?
Yes, PSG Reader. So that's Reader. I'm not even trying to explain what it means anymore.
Now's where you pass it on to somebody else. You have to do that.
Penal scrotal genital reader. Yeah.
Of course, if you want to really delight Tom and everyone else, you can always email us at mtgpotpourri@gatheringmagic.com.
I like emails.
That's mtgpotpourri, all one word, @gatheringmagic.com.
Just Google how to spell it. Yeah.
It's great.
I've misspelled it myself. Emailing and submitting these articles to gatheringmagic.com. Is there two P's? Oh, whatever. Shit.
That's dumb. I'm Adam Sworsky. You can find me on Twitter at @the_Stibs, STYBS. That's my nickname. You can always email me, Stibs@gatheringmagic.com. You can read my Thursday article on MagicTheGathering.com. That's the official Magic the Gathering website. I write Command Tower. So if you like Commander, I'm always down to talk about that. And you'll find me at Grand Prix all over the United States. Next one's going to be Grand Prix Las Vegas, so pre-register, sign up, and get there. Conley.
I don't even know if I can talk because there's a cat that's going to pop up any second and she's going to completely interrupt me. No! Stop!
Don't look at Smush. Look at the viewer.
The ugliest cat I've ever had.
Lock the screen. Alright, I can't see Smush now. I am Conley Woods. You can find me on Twitter at Conley81. Working on some Deck Doctor for ChannelFireball.com. That'll be coming out soon. I had to wait until after the new cards were available online to record anything else, so I did. Also, articles on TCGPlayer.com, including the one on the Rug deck that I was talking about earlier. By the time you read this, there'll probably be an article on some other deck. And hopefully I win the PTQ this weekend. So that's that.
So you said you're going to Albuquerque? Okay. Right. How long of a drive is that?
It's not that far. It's like 4.5 hours.
That's crazy. You can get to New Mexico, Albuquerque from where you are to the same amount of time it takes me to drive to Fargo, North Dakota.
I guess. It seems like...
Fargo is just into North... Basically, it's Moorhead, Minnesota, and then Fargo.
Denver's like halfway through, like right in the middle of Colorado, and Albuquerque is like 100 miles south of the border in New Mexico, so it's like not that ridiculous.
We're in the Midwest.
I mean, I grew up in Chicago. I understand how this works.
Midwest, Conley. Minnesota. It's right next to Canada.
Thank you. I was born in Dayton, Ohio, grew up in Chicago and Gary, Indiana.
That's a lot of boring places to be from, yeah.
It is, I agree. unless you live there now, and then you can argue about religious freedom.
Where is this?
In Indiana.
Oh, is that where the bunch of the
Americans
are going?
Yeah, exactly. All right,
but we won't even open that can of worms. Is that
exactly?
Good fun there.
Literally went straight to Dunn from Indiana religious freedom law. Not going to talk about that one because I just feel like it won't end for a while.
Yeah, there's really no way to win.
Yeah,
same with putting snakes up your penis. There's just not
going to be. That guy won until he lost, right?
Well, I guess at least you enjoyed it, though.
Exactly. He had to enjoy it in order to repeat it. Like, it's not like he was like, oh, that really sucks. Another. Yeah. Like, he wasn't doing that.
So it's like, simply, I can't blame you. I mean, it's just like smoking or something. I mean,
I want to know if after the surgery, if he continued or not.
Especially if you know like an ER physician, just ask them for their stories of like rectal foreign objects. It is fantastic. Basically, if it even is remotely like the first time you hear the story about the person driving themselves to the ER, basically sitting on the car seat, you know, feet in the car seat, and using one hand to work the pedal, one hand to steer because they have the bowling pin shoved in their ass. Most people have seen that one.
Literally, this is why we need a video cast because Adam said maybe because
the guy because you have to stand on the seat like this is it literally like driving in.
Everything. There's been kinks in the neck. There's been like tears coming down. Sweat has been building up on his forehead. This is why we need.
Next, we'll also talk about my review of Paul Blart 2.
No, first of all, it got a 0% on Rotten Tomatoes. If you get a 0% on Rotten Tomatoes, you are not allowed to make more movies. It's the rule.
It's Kevin James. I will watch anything he's in. It could be Paul Blart 3, Triple X.
They filmed that for $30 million, and so far it's only made $7 million worldwide. So they're losing.
I donated about $650 of that right there. I enjoyed it. With the six other people that are in the theater with me.
All right. Now people are tuning in to get our Twitter information right now, and it's too late because we're talking about nothing.
No. We can say, we already said it. We're done.
We're done.
I'll stop the recording. Go get my bowling pins.
Bye, everybody.